We are up to... Yeah, please. We are up to the fifth chapter in Zechariah. And we're always a little bit creaky getting back from being, we were on break for 2 weeks. They get a little rusty. But Zechariah's visions are steaming away. He has no pause here. In this parak, in this chapter, he will actually have three visions. One, a vision of a scroll of punishment, as we'll see. Second, an ephah, which is a volume measure, but it's a receptacle that holds a certain measure. And finally, a vision of a pair of women. And this chapter, well, we'll see, but it's basically the theme in general is punishment. And the question, of course, is who is being punished and why? What exactly is this vision? It's very different from what we've seen until now in the book, where the themes until now, if you'll recall, we had the vision of the horses, right? And the malachut, the horses. We have, of course, the vision of the menorah, and then the vision of the horns. Until now, it's been about punishing the nations and rescuing the Jews from their exile, whether we're talking about to build the second temple or whether we're talking about an ultimate time of Mashiach. This is going to be a left turn. Perek Hei Pasuk Aleph, chapter 5, sentence 1. What I'd like to do is read through Psukim Aleph to Dalet, sentences 1 to 4, and see what's going on, get a sort of view of the landscape, and then start to break it down and potentially get some answers. Everyone have sheets? Okay. If you're using the Koren Tanakh, Koren Tanakh is probably page 714, I'm going to guess. 715? Did we make it to 715?
714.
714, not quite. Okay. No, 715. 715 indeed.
Oh, sorry.
Yep, 715. All right. We did make it there. So, Va'ashuv. Everyone have it? Va'ashuv. And then I returned... Or I turned, as the Koran has it. Here you go. Va'esa einai, and I raised my eyes. Va'ereh, and I saw. Vihine megila afa. Behold, there was a scroll afa. Afa is an odd word. For the moment, we'll take the Koran's translation, which says flying, like oaf is a bird. So there was a flying scroll. Interesting. Vayomer Eli, Pasuk Bet, sentence 2, and he said to me, who said to me? Presumably the Malach who's been speaking to him all along. Ma taroeh, what do you see?
Once again.
Yeah, that's a popular question. Vaomar, and I said, you can sort of see Zechariah's audience as he's speaking, saying, and I saw a scroll, and then the angel turned to me, and there's a chorus of everybody, yeah, he said, what did you see? We know. Vaomar, and I said, master of the obvious, ani roeh megila afa, I see a flying scroll. Not squirrel, scroll. Arka esrim ba'ama v'rochba eser ba'ama. It was 20 amos long. An ama is a cubit. We generally put it as between a foot and a half and 2 feet, depending on the measure that you assign to it, which basically comes back to how big your fingers are, how big the average fingers are of people in a particular time. The Ramosha Feinstein put the number for an ama as 21.6 inches. The calculation is based on the idea that a tefach, a hand breadth, is 4 fingers across. He measured and found that the average finger breadth, the breadth of the finger right here, or the thumb really over here, was 0.9 inches. And so he multiplied that by 4 to get 3.6 inches. And then there are 6 hand breadths to an amma, hence 21.6 inches. That's how he came up with the number, which does not stop anybody from disagreeing with him. But you can imagine now, Zechariah sees this scroll and he says, well, it's 20 amos long and 10 amos wide, which is pretty good, measuring a scroll as it's flying in the air. My suspicion is that this is part of his prophetic realization. No problem. I do that regularly. My wife inevitably pulls out pages from the printer after I leave the house and gives them to me that night and says, tell me, did you need this today? The scroll I believe what's going on is not that Zechariah is actually measuring the scroll in the air and saying, well, that looks like 20 by 10, but I think it's part of his vision. In other words, it's communicated into his brain. This is a scroll that is 20 amos by 10 amos. That's my tendency on this. I've now given out the last of the sheets. These are my notes from last year. So the Vayomer Eli, sentence 3, and he said to me, he, again, presumably this Malach, Zos ha'Allah hayotzeis al panei chol ha'aretz. This is the Allah. The word Allah is usually used in Tanakh to mean a curse. This is the curse. Hayotzeis al panei chol ha'aretz, which is traveling over the entire land. Ki chol ha'gonev mize kamoha nika. That is a cryptic turn of phrase, these last couple of clauses. The Quran will tell us, for every thief has been hitherto quit of this which is on it.
No.
There you go, right?
Wow, that's clear as can be.
What it means, the way that he's taking it, is that the word nika comes from the term naki, to be found innocent or clean, to be exonerated. It can be. So he says, Mizeh kamoha nika, anyone who has stolen has been clean of what's written on this scroll until now. Anyone who has taken an oath inappropriately has been innocent, has gotten away with it until now. So he's saying, this scroll records the punishment that is coming. The punishment is coming for the entire land. We're in chapter 5, sentence 3. Because until now, people have been getting away with an awful lot. And then last sentence in this section, Hotzei Siha, I have taken her out. Her is the scroll. Megillah is feminine. I have taken out the scroll. Ne'um Hashem Tzvakos. This is the message of Hashem, God. That same phrase that we've seen over and over again in Zechariah. Uva el beis haganov. It's going to come to the house of the thief. Ve'el beis hanishba b'shmi lashaker. And to the house of the one who has sworn in my name falsely. Ve'lane b'soch beiso. And it is going to stay in his house. The house of the thief. The house of the person who swears inappropriately. Lane is generally understood to be like lana. She will rest. Lalun is to remain. The v'chilatu. Vers 8, sub vers Avanov, and it is going to destroy it, meaning destroy the house, like Vayichulu is to conclude something, but Kale is often used to destroy. So it will destroy the house, and not only the house, vers 8, sub vers Avanov, and its wood and its stones, meaning everything is going to be gone, everything will be demolished. That is the opening vision of the three visions in this chapter. What do you see here? What should bother us within this? Where do you start? Yeah, right. You missed my introduction to it, but I said this is completely out of whack with what came before. Everything before this was very happy and upbeat for us. This is a real turnaround.
Generally, we have. This is what you're doing wrong, and if you don't write it, this is your punishment. We haven't seen that sequence of events.
Right, he's sort of sandwiching it into one. Right? He's saying, the punishment is coming for those of you who have been sinning, who have gotten off scot-free until now. Yes?
Why have they gotten off scot-free until now?
Right. What's going on here? He says, well, until now, you've been free of any punishment. Well, why is that? Where did this come from? What else?
Well, first of all, isn't it funny that he's talking about this flying scroll and its measurements?
Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
Where did this come from? I mean, not that this is any stranger than, mysterious horses that talk. But still, what does a scroll mean to the Jews at that point? What is the image of a scroll in Tanakh? Yeah, and it's in the sky, yes, although that's one explanation of Afa. We don't actually know that, but that's is what we've used until now. And what's with the dimensions? It's not like he used them in the explanation.
Yeah.
The scroll is 20 amos by 10 amos. And? What do we have anything else that's 20 amos by 10 amos? Is this a common theme? Is it 200 square amos? What? It's a football field? What are we talking about?
The rabbi.
The Mishkan?
The Mishkan was
Is there something in the Michigan?
Some 10 figures into the Michigan, but not for this. Not in, not in an area. The height of the walls is 10 amos. Sorry?
I mean, one thinks of, well, we think of the Torah as scrolls, so one
right.
thinks of that from the, though it wasn't originally a scroll, but it was a scroll. You wrote, I mean, that's the impression of
right.
what Moshe wrote, in,
right.
you know, at the end. I mean, we think of it from the sky, and then I was going to say, so what in the Mishkan, or what is kind of Mizbeach, or what is 10 by, what has, does anything have a measurement? You've asked us, but
we have measurements, but not this one.
I'm not sure about the measurements, but weren't scrolls always sent as messages? Like people would send a scroll to send information back and forth.
Yeah, but then you need an owl, no? The
Rawlings hadn't.
Right. So then they were a carrier pigeon. I mean, you don't usually just drop the scroll and expect
runners.
Someone to find it.
You had runners.
Right. You had runners. That's true. And you have later in history. Later in history, we become we use this image of a scroll falling. If you think of Baruch Sha'amar and the tradition that the Baruch Sha'amar prayer actually was found on a scroll that fell from the heavens. You find that idea there, but that's way after Zechariah. So,
why are scrolls in heaven?
So, yeah, what does that mean? Does God need a scroll? Is this a new way of communicating? There's no Moshe anymore to go up the mountain, so therefore God's just going to chuck the scroll down. And
Was it the image or the message? Like, is the content?
Yeah.
You've always talked to us about the fact, you know, with each one of the Nevi'im, their life, where they're coming from, the kind of life they led has impacted on the way that they relate
right.
their message. So I guess I guess my question is, and he has a strange, and he's relating it in a very strange way all the
yeah.
way along.
Oh yes, and we said from week one with Zechariah that one view is that he has visions because he's on a lower level, and in general they're on a lower level now, and so therefore everything has to be communicated to them cryptically. Alternatively, it's because he's perceiving deep things that venture far into the future, and therefore necessarily it's going to be more opaque. But yeah,
his images
this is
are usually very rich, and they're sort of metaphoric. Whatever. This one just seems like a message from us. I got an email.
Right. Although there's more coming. There's more coming within the chapter. This really is one message in three parts.
Saying, like God saying, read my Torah, read the scroll, you know, read the answer.
Right. It's sort of like, here's... Right, so to speak, right. It's a Dylan-esque type of an image here. You have the Torah scroll, and it's in the wind. Yes, maybe. It's clearly a rebuke for sin, right? That we understand, because he said so explicitly, right? He said so straightforward. This is a rebuke for sin. It doesn't fit at all, therefore, with the encouragement we've seen before. So what the commentators tend to do is to say it's a description of sin and punishment of others, not the good guys who are going to merit the building of the Beis HaMikdash, whether the second one or whether an ultimate messianic one. So the question still is, well, whom? So, yeah.
Why exactly theft and perjury?
Another question, right? We identify two sins here. Theft and perjury. Now, the truth is, like, those aren't bad sins to choose.
I was saying they're very much between man and man kind of sin.
Which is consistent with the rest of Triassar,
right?
The overwhelming majority of the rebukes we've seen in Triassar with the last, you know, the last seven or eight Nevi'im that we've looked at has been about Ben Adam HaChavera, the way one person relates to another, abuse of the poor, corruption in judgment. Yeah, that's been sort of a standard. Take a look at your first source on the sheet, please. Take a look at Radak. We're going to see, surprise, Radak versus Abarbanel. Radak says, Lo nisbarer al ezez man nemar zos hanevuah. He says, I'll be forthright with you. It's not at all clear here who the audience is, for what time period this is meant. V'nira ki al zman hanavi nemar. But he says, it appears that this is about the time of that prophet, meaning Zechariah. Ki ra'inu b'sefer Ezra harbe averos shahayu b'yadam. Because you have to read the parallel texts that are describing the generation. And if you look in Ezra, describing the Jews of those times, he lists various sins. V'al ha'gneva v'al shvuas sheker yatzu zos ha'alah, and the curse comes out for these two in particular, theft and false oaths. He says what it's really about is the false oath. Because remember that a false oath invokes the name of God. So we think of it as a social sin, because you corrupt the system of justice by swearing falsely. But it's not just a social sin, it's also against God, because you invoke God's name in vain. So therefore it has sort of the worst of both worlds. And theft, he says, is along for the ride, because theft leads a person to swear falsely, because he's tried for the sin and he has to testify falsely in order to exonerate himself. So it's really about false oaths, as Radak sees it, and it's about the sins of that generation. So whereas until now we've been encouraged, you're going to see the Beis HaMikdash built and not to worry, now we're told there's a group that's not going to see it. And that's this group that's guilty of the false oaths and the theft that leads to false oaths. That's Radak. Abarbanel says no. He says this is about the future. Just like the building that he saw was about a third Beis HaMikdash, this is about a future destruction, specifically the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. And he fits it in ingeniously. I have my questions about whether this qualifies as pshat, as a simple read, but I'll tell you that he makes a compelling argument. He says, After the Malach informed the prophet about the future redemption, b'maras haMenorah, with the vision of the menorah, ra'lahu di'o inyan churban bayis sheni v'galus b'nei Yehuda shaya asid lios shama. He then informed him of the destruction of the Second Temple and the exile of Yehuda, which would ultimately happen. So in other words, you saw the visions of the menorah, Maros HaMenorah. You now need to know about the destruction of the Second Beis HaMikdash.
And that's the house that's being destroyed completely.
Exactly. Okay. Why? Lefi shelo yiksha be'enei hanavi eicha ve'eichacha tischaber ha-geula ha'asida le'binyan ba'yesheni. Because this poor Navi Zechariah is standing there telling people, we're going to build a second temple, we're going to build a second temple, and you're telling him there's going to be a third one. He has to sort of put two and two together and say, wait, what happened in between? So there must be some kind of devastation occurring at some point, or there wouldn't be a need for messianic time. So this is there to fill in the blank for the Navi. My question is, and what about the people he's telling this to? You're now encouraging them to build a house that you told them is going to be destroyed. You know, there's a Gemara about this, right? Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus, right? Turnus Rufus challenges Rabbi Akiva about Jewish belief. And one of the things that he says to him is, how do you have a concept of Vayinachem Hashem, that God could regret something? What does that mean? If God regrets something, then, and he's omniscient, why didn't he just prevent it from happening? Why did he go down that road in the first place if he knew it was going to lead to a bad conclusion? To which Rabbi Akiva replies, do you have a son? And he says, yes. And he says, when your son was born, didn't you make a party and a celebration? He says, yes. Well, don't you know what happens to everybody in the end? How could you celebrate and be happy? And Turnus Rufus' response is, because we celebrate at the time of joy and we're sad at the time of sadness. We don't sit there at the time of a birth and worry about, you know, any sorrows that are going to happen down the line. So having said that, that's exactly what the Navi is doing here. He's encouraging them to build a second Beis HaMikdash, but according to Abarbanel, he's saying, by the way, you should know there's trouble coming. I guess he doesn't want to ruin his reputation as a prophet, because prophets under union rules within Judaism have to say something bad is going to happen. So he says that's what this was about, how this current building would relate to the future Geula. And he has to answer the question of why we don't simply have the ingathering of exiles now. Why not let this be the time of Mashiach? And his answer is, because people are stealing, and because people are swearing falsely, and therefore we aren't worthy yet.
But it's very nice what Abarbanel is saying, but psychologically it's very strange, as you say, when they're building. He's not just saying we're not having a full ingathering of exiles, let's say, as was predicted, let's say, at the end of Devarim. He's talking about destruction. I mean, this would not encourage anybody to go and start building.
Right. I mean, this would encourage me to take out a good insurance policy on the building. This is really difficult. It is difficult to envision. The only way I can see this working is if implicit within his warning is the idea that it really is only a warning. That you could still right the wrong, you could still stop stealing, and then this could become the ultimate redemption.
But we haven't heard that yet.
We have not seen that here.
But he also could be saying, we need that temple, and there's going to be trouble, and they need the temple, they have to pray, and they have to try to ward off.
So we're building this as a way to combat what may happen.
Maybe
it's a good idea. Right. Could be. Definitely could be. So this let's look and turn from the overview of what's being said here to the actual psukim. And one of the questions we asked was, what's with the scroll? So take a look in your Tanakh, please, at Yechezkel, chapter 2, the end of chapter 2. It is page...
613.
Thank you. 613. Good page. Chapter 2, sentence 8 is where we begin. Yechezkel also is a Navi, a prophet who sees visions. Probably the one, I think, even more than the Zechariah, not percentage-wise, but just in general, he's the only one in Tanakh, I think, that has more visions, than, except maybe Yosef also, than Zechariah.
Yes, he is.
Atzamot HaYeveshos and bricks and all sorts of other fun stuff. Yechezkel is really something. I've never taught Yechezkel. That's something to do one day. But there are a lot of prakim in Yechezkel. Very long and very dense.
Yes.
But take a look at Pasuk Chetch, sentence 8 there. He says, son of man, which is the traditional way to refer to Yechezkel. He says, listen to what I'm telling you. Don't be rebellious like that house of rebellion. Open up your mouth and eat that which I'm going to give you. Well, what's that? Vo'eres, sentence 9. I saw, v'hine yad shlucha elai, and a hand was extended towards me. Vehine bo megilas sefer, and there was a scroll in it. Vayifros osa lefanai, he spread it out in front of me. Vehik suva panim v'achor, it had writing on it, front and back, which is a detail we did not have in our story. Vechasuv eleha kinim v'hege v'hi, and written on it was kinim, which Lamentations is as good a translation as any. Think of keynotes that are said on Tisha B'Av. It's the same word, although with a masculine plural. Vahege, which they render here as mourning, and vahi, he, like woe. It's like a wailing cry. Think of a high-pitched wail. Vayomer Eli, and he said to me, chapter 3, Ben Adam, son of man, Es asher timtza echol. He says, eat whatever you find. Echol es hamegilah azos. Eat this scroll, and this is still in the vision, v'lech daber el beis Yisrael, and go speak to the Jews. The image of eating the scroll may be internalizing the message. It becomes a part of you.
I'll eat my words.
Eat your words, right? Eating God's words, maybe. No word on how filling it is. V'eftach es pi, but I think it has carbs. V'eftach es pi, and I opened my mouth, Vayachileni eis hamegilah hazos, and he fed me this scroll, and then it continues. That's another scroll. Note that the scroll has writing on both sides. That's going to matter for what we're going to say. There, it is a scroll of punishment. As you see from Kinim Vahege Vahi, it's about lamentations and wailing. Bad things are going to happen.
And we know nothing about what's on that scroll.
And we know nothing, exactly.
Yeah.
We have a sort of inference by saying that he's told that the thieves have been exonerated from or have been exempted from the punishment that's on our scroll. But he doesn't actually see any writing on our scroll at all. For all we know, our scroll is blank. This scroll, he actually sees writing on it front and back. So that's a significant difference between the two. Radak comments and says this is part of the idea that prophecy had diminished. Whereas Abarbanel, who doesn't believe prophecy has diminished, says, again, it's because this is a vision that's far in the future, and therefore it's opaque, Zechariah's vision. Whereas Yechezkel is talking about things that are happening in his own day, the punishment of the Jews at the end of the First Temple, and therefore it's more clear. So everyone could take it in their own way, but you're right, we didn't know anything about writing, whereas here we're told explicitly that the prophet sees it. Okay, that's a scroll. Our scroll is Afa, which we take to mean flying. Not everyone will agree with that, though. We said it was flying. Flying works as an explanation for Afa, not just because of the association with the word oath, but also because we're going to see more flying in the rest of this chapter. We're going to see a flying Afa, sort of a picture. We're going to see flying women. Everything is flying in this chapter. So it makes sense that this scroll is flying. Also, the word Afa should mean flying. However, there are two other approaches that are suggested. The word Af in Aramaic can mean double. The word Af can mean double. Eif is the way it's usually rendered. Ayin Yud Pei. It means for something to be doubled over. Like the word Kefel in Hebrew, which we take to mean double, is rendered Eif. I think in the pasuk when it talks about one of the garments of the Kohen, how it had a seam, it had a hem really, that was doubled over. So it's described as kaful in the Torah, but it's eif in the Aramaic on the Torah. So afa can mean doubled. Why would it be doubled? Let's take a look, please, at Radak in source number 4. Radak says, Vizo ki inyan Megillah Shara Yechezkel. This is like the scroll Yechezkel saw. Shaisak Suva Panim Viachor, which was recorded, had writing on it front and back. Vachin Zos HaMegillah Isak Suva Mizeo Mizeh. This one also was front and back. Vaisak Suva Mitzad Echad Kol HaGonev Nikah Mitzad Echad Kol HaNishba Nikah. What it actually said was, all who steal Nikah. I didn't translate the word Nikah in the translation because we're not there yet. And the other side, it said, all who swear, Nikah. So in other words, the actual vision that he had, where he was told these words, that's what's written on the scroll. And the scroll is doubled. That's the way that Radak explains it. Double-sided writing. The Gemara, which we're going to see soon, says that it wasn't that it was written front and back, but that it was folded. And we'll see why folded matters. We'll get to that. And Ibn Ezra says about this, Ein Tam LePerusho. He says, I've seen those who have said this, and they're just wrong. He says, there's no logic to this explanation. It means that it's flying and be done with it. But we have these two different schools of thought, and then there's a third school of thought, which we're not going to take a lot of time on, but I gave you the reference if you want to look it up at some point in source number 5. Yefet, an earlier grammarian cited in Ibn Ezra, says it means spread out. And the scroll was spread out from Yeshaya, right. So we have a scroll. We understand, based on what's told to Zechariah, that it's a scroll of punishment. We have an image like this in Yechezkel, in which he sees a flying scroll with punishment on it. So it's not only here, it's seen there. We have the image of, I think it was flying there too, and we have the image of double-sided writing or something as a distinct possibility too. What about the size of it? The 20 amot by 10 amot. What is that about? So what we do have, the dimensions we do have are these. In the ulam, the big room in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, the entrance was 40 amot tall by 20 amot wide. This is big. I mean, 40 amot, based on the numbers we gave before, is about 70 feet. Okay, your entrance is 70 feet tall and 30 to 35 or so feet wide. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara and Baba Basra about what this teaches us about structures and how wide a wall needs to be at the base in order to reach a certain height. It's a fascinating physics discussion where they're discussing building materials and liability if you build a wall and it collapses and who owns what from the... It's a fascinating discussion, and this is the largest building anyone ever heard of, so that's what they use as their model for sort of what the maximum is that you can achieve. In other words, no one views it Talmudically as a miraculous thing that it stood. They just say, this was built really well. So what does 40 by 20 have to do with 20 by 10?
He's like ten.
Kaful, right? If you double it. If you double it, then you have 40 by 20, maybe. Take a look at what happens in the Gemara. Source number 6. See, we intuitively say 40 by 20 is double 20 by 10, but we know that that's not true when we think about it, right? What happens if you double 20 by 10? What do you get? Either 40 by 10, right, or 20 by 20.
Don't you find the square cubits, like 10
times
scale. 20 is like how many squares by 100?
Yeah, but it won't work. It won't work if you double it.
But
it's a scaled version of it.
You find the area.
What you do is you just need to multiply it by 4, right? What you want to do is multiply it by 4. So 20 by 10, if you multiply the width first, and then you multiply the length, and each time you multiply it by 2, then you will end up with 40 by 20. So watch what the Gemara does. Source number 6. Maidichziv. The Gemara is bothered by a pasuk that doesn't have anything to do with us directly, but it leads into ours. L'chol techla ra'isi keitz rechava mitzvascha me'od. The pasuk, the sentence in Tehillim, says, for every entity there is an end. Rechava mitzvascha me'od, your mitzvot are very broad. What does that mean? What is the author telling us there? So Davar ze amaro David velo persho. David, King David, said this and didn't explain it. Amro Iov, Job said it as well, velo persho, but he didn't explain it either. Amro Yechezkel velo persho, Yechezkel said it, he didn't explain it either. Ad sheba Zechariah ben Ido upersho, until Zechariah ben Ido, our Zechariah, came and explained it. What do you mean? Amro David v'lo persho, David said it and didn't explain it. That's the sentence in Tehillim and Psalms that we just read. I skipped things in my English translation just for space reasons, but I'll read it in the Hebrew. Amro Iov v'lo persho, Iov said it but didn't explain it. Tichsiv aruka me'eretz midah urchava mini yam. Iov said, her length is longer than the land and wider than the sea. Right? Her being, in context, a reference to Torah. Amr Yechezkel v'lo persho, Yechezkel said it and didn't explain it. That's the sentence that we just read. That he spread out the scroll, and it was written on front and back, but again, he didn't explain it. Ad sheba Zechariah ben Ido upersho, until Zechariah came along and he explained it with our sentence. What do you mean? What is he explaining and how is he explaining it? As follows. Vayomer elai ma ata ro'eh? The Malach said to me, what do you see? Va'omar, and I said, ani ro'eh megila afa arka v'esrim v'ama v'rach v'esrim v'ama. I saw a scroll that was afa, and it was 20 amos long and 10 amos wide. Note what I did in my translation there. He says, folded. The Gemara says, afa, meaning folded. Therefore, v'chipashtis la, if you unfold it, Havila Esrin Be'esrin. Then it's 20 by 20. In other words, it looked like it was 20 by 10, like this, right? Then I unfolded it, and suddenly it was 20 by 20. This dimension stays the same, this dimension is double. So therefore it becomes 20 by 20. Then, Uksiv Hiksuva Panim Ve'achor, he takes the sentence from Yechezkel, not from Zechariah. He's assuming this is the same scroll. So therefore, takes a sentence from Yechezkel, which said exactly, it's written front and back, v'chikalfas la, if you were to peel it, such that you could put the texts side by side, right, then kama avila, how big will it be? Arba'in be'esrin, 40 by 20. Uchsiv, and then he says, Mibadad b'shalo, yam b'shamayim b'zeres tikein. The pasuk in Yeshaya, there's a mem there that I believe is wrong. I think it says, maybe it's mayim, but I thought it was yam. Mibadad b'shalo yam, I thought. In any case, actually, the pasuk itself matters. The word, whether it's yam or mayim, doesn't matter so much. Shana, you let me know. But the pasuk says, who measured the sea in his hand?
Mayim.
It is Mayim? Okay, my mistake. Thank you. Who measured the sea in his hand and founded the heavens with his zeret. A zeret is half of an amma. Okay? So now, God founded the heavens with it. We use it for the pinky. Correct. And this is the amma. The Zeret is half of the Yama. So the idea is that the Zeret is half an Yama, and God used that for the heavens. So that means that the world is 0.5 Yama, 0.5 cubits by 0.5 cubits, as compared to the scroll, which is 40 by 20. So therefore the world is 1/3200, if you can say that without lisping, of the Torah. Huh? The 0.5 by 0.5 amot versus 40 by 20 amos. Do the math, and it's indeed 1/3200 is the ratio. What this teaches me, aside from that the sages like to do math, is that it teaches me that they think Torah is written on the scroll. Right? That's what Torah is meant to represent. Which is now the explanation of the line from Io, from Job, that that Torah is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. Right? Because it's so much greater. Now, what does that mean to us philosophically? What is it saying? It's not really about numbers, right? What is it really trying to say?
The Torah applies to every aspect of life.
Right.
The Torah reigns over everything. It's more important right. than anything.
Right. To a certain extent, size is an indicator of importance, yeah. Like it or not. What else?
A sampling of the physical world is fleeting and insignificant when compared to the Torah.
Right. This world is just is here and gone when you compare it to Torah. I think it's also a statement that the Torah is meant to address more than this world. The Rambam would love this idea. Because the Rambam is of the opinion that human beings are not the purpose of creation. We are a purpose of creation, but there's more going on that we don't figure into. And I gave a class a couple of weeks ago on aliens, on extraterrestrial life. Rav Sadia Gaon believes that human beings are the center of all. Human beings are the most important thing in the universe. We have free will. Nothing else has free will. Ergo, we are the purpose of creation. And the Rambam says absolutely not. The Rambam says there could very well be intelligent beings out there. He doesn't talk about it in terms of angel of aliens. He talks about it in terms of whatever, angel, malach, whatever term you want to throw on it. And he says that there are beings out there who don't exist because we need them. They exist because they exist. God has some other function for them. That fits in very well with this idea of the earth being one corner of Torah. There's a lot more in Torah than just human beings.
What I understand is that Megillah from above is folding the whole world. It's folding the whole human thinking and everything. It's within.
Right, but right.
I can't relate to it otherwise. It's so.
Haggadah.
Yes. Definitely that.
It's up in the air.
Yeah, but it's up in the air, cute. I think all of this is there. So
wouldn't it also be like the awesomeness of God? Like so like humans can't really totally understand all of
right.
God. The whole
right.
The size and the awesomeness of it.
Right. I think that has to be taken as part of it, is certainly that. It's sort of, who are you human being? Mm-hmm. Which fits, of course, with the EO reference, because that's what the book is all about.
Having this message about the connection between the world and Torah at the same time as we're getting this message about the people who are stealing it.
Right.
I think we're learning for Zechariah from this Gemara. That's not quite the message of Zechariah. This is telling us what some
right.
of Chazal thought was on this.
Well, I think there are multiple messages seen here. I don't think that's Zechariah's message to them. I think that's a message which although then the question is, well, then why do you mention the dimensions? But we're going to answer that in a second. But I think there are multiple layers here that can be drawn from it. One which ties into his message to his people at the time, and the other which is a broader theme. In terms of what this has to do with anything, well, once we take the idea that it's written on both sides and that it's folded, and therefore it's 40 by 20, like the entrance to the Beis Hamikdash, Ibn Ezra says, and the Medrash in Vayikra Rabba says it as well, that it's not just a flying scroll. It's a scroll flying out of the Beis Hamikdash. It's a scroll emerging from the temple. Correct. Why? So Rashi says that it's departing from before God in order to cause punishment. Abarbanel says, similarly, these sins lead to punishment from God. In other words, it's the size of the entrance to the temple, because it's emerging from there to say punishment is coming from this temple, and Abarbanel will say that's the destruction of the temple.
So it's metaphorically soaring.
Yes.
Listen, there's limitless interpretation to this temple.
Yes.
And all these measurements and the theory that he gives, he's really giving us a boundary. A sort of boundary, you know, to the interpretation.
You think a boundary or a limitless boundary? Limitless. Because we could, it feels very gematria-like. Gematria-like. You can always add unfold it.
He's specific about the measurements. Mm-hmm. And this I see as a bit of a boundary. You know, you can think in this term.
Right. I mean, no, it's true that once you put a number on it, the number must have meaning and guide you in terms of what you're going to do. But it's also true that numbers, we're pretty good with numbers. You know, we can do an awful lot with numbers. This is certainly one way to take it, because the Gemara takes it that way. It gives it a certain authority.
I think we look for something because we know that if we like to think that the numbers meant something to his audience. So the question is, what did it...
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think that's what we see. So what did it mean to them? And what, when they heard 10 by 20, what did it... What was conjured up in their mind?
And that's what I think... One is a square, the other one's a rectangle. Yeah. The is connected.
Not to mention, we pulled a bait and switch, you know, in this. Oh, come on. Go back to source number 6, please. In source number 6, we quoted the sentence from Yeshaya 40:12 at the end there, right? Who measured the sea in his hand and founded the heavens with his zeret. Right? God's zeret. God's zeret versus in Zechariah, when he said it was 20 amos by 10 amos. Do you think he's talking about God's amma? A divine amma, so to speak? In other words, we're just kind of assuming that you can put all these on the same scale.
Right.
You could definitely argue that point. We sort of put two different scales on this.
I don't know. I mean, maybe if you're a flying Megillah, it is a divine amma.
Maybe. But if you're Zechariah, how did you measure that inside of... I mean, the answer is he didn't. It was just planted in his head. But
we do that... Maybe I'm wrong. But we do that in, let's say, taking the donkey. We take all the donkeys and say they were all the same donkey. I mean, so we're taking all the scrolls and saying they're the same.
Oh, that's true. No, mixing the scrolls, I definitely think you can do. It's the Amma thing that bothers me a little bit. But in any case, we have now explained and we fairly understand the first two sentences in chapter 5.
You think?
Yes. What he's saying is, I saw a flying or folded scroll. The scroll was of the measure 20 by 10, which when you unfold it and play games with it, ends up being the same as the entrance to the Beis HaMikdash. It is a scroll of punishment that we are taken to understand, and it's linked, we're told, to the scroll of Yechezkel, which was a scroll of punishment written on both sides and much more clear in general than ours. But what exactly is written on the scroll? So the Gemara thinks it's the Torah. Right, that we just saw. The Gemara thinks it's the Torah which contains the punishments.
But
Rashi,
but Yechezkel, you don't have that sense from Yechezkel.
From Yechezkel, it
could be, but we don't think of the Torah as being lamentations and woe and. There is some. Oh yes, okay, but it's not just that. We hope it's not.
I mean, Rashi here and Radak say it's the curse itself that's written there, right? We saw that already in Radak in source number 4, where he said one side says all who steal nikah, and the other one says all who swear nikah. So he thinks it's the curse itself that's on there. Abarbanel, of course, goes his own way. If you take a look at source number 7, top of the second side. This paper is written front and back.
And if you unfold it?
Then it'll still be written front and back. That's all I'll tell you.
From the scroll.
Yeah. Ukvar Zachar Yechezkel, Shara HaMegillah Ha'ik, Suva Panim Ve'achor. Yechezkel already mentioned that he saw this scroll. Again, we're assuming it's the same scroll. Bearing writing front and back. And Vishaya Kasu by Hidim Vahega Vahaya, and it sat on in lamentations and moaning and woe. Lefisha Magila Hiremez Ligzera Haelokis, Mechareves and Machreves Es Hauma. Because the scroll is a hint of the divine decree to destroy the nation. Velachain Ra Osa Yechezkel Benevu Alahachrib Bayis Rishon. So Yechezkel saw the scroll as a sign of the pending destruction of the first temple. Or not pending, because by the time he says it, it's already happened. And Zechariah is seeing the scroll. The scroll is sort of an evil harbinger. You know, it's a sign of disaster to come. there's no reason you can't recycle. It's that. And I didn't bring it on the sheet. I was going to, but I didn't do so. He says it's the list of sins, and what it is a tab.
Yeah.
Right? It's a tab. In other words, the people did this, the people did this, the people did this, and eventually God decides to call in the tab. That's what Abarba Nel believes is written on it. So this scroll, though...
Why doesn't it say sweep of God's
cup? That's beyond where we're going today. It's a good question, but it's beyond where we're going.
For Abarba Nel, it starts growing in the first temple, and it doesn't get wiped out by destruction. It just keeps growing. This our laundry list of.
Or it's a new list. But look at there's one thing that's really troublesome in this explanation. If you take a look at sentence number 3, notice that it says, "Vayomer Eli," he said to me, "Zos ha'Allah hayotzeis al pene chol ha'aretz." You see that? If this is really about the punishment of destruction of the temple, why is this traveling throughout the land? Ibn Ezra doesn't seem to care. He just says it's about Jews around the world. But, yeah.
The temple is Israel.
Right, Radak says Aretz means Israel. It isn't Kol Haaretz, the world, it's Kol Haaretz, the Aretz, which to a Jew is going to mean the land of Israel. That's the way that he explains it. So, what exactly is it that is said? One who steals, one who swears falsely, will be Nika, like the paper. So what is Nika? Take a look, please, at source number 1. Ibn Ezra takes it.
8.
And source number 8, thank you. As a reference to innocence. Nika, like Naki. Hayakasub b'megillah mizatzad hagonev Nika. And mitzad sheni hanishba Nika. On one side it said one who steals Nika. On the other side it said one who swears Nika. O mize, umize. Alternatively, it said on both sides ki aganav hanishba Nika. On each side it said the thief and one who swears Nika. Vehu nachon, and that he says is more correct. In other words, it's the same text on both sides. Vitam Nika. The message is that the thief and the person who swears think that God has found them innocent. So people think that God has been nake, that God has found them innocent. That's the way that Ibn Ezra takes it. Rashi says, no, it's actual innocence. They haven't found innocent until now. Rashi in source number 9, Nikav v'lo nishtalim puranus yechidim ha'ovrim ala Torah. The punishment of individuals who violate the Torah hasn't taken place. Ela himtin ach nismales sas kulam. Rather, the punishment waited for the measure. The measure meaning sort of you have up to here and then no more. So the measure had to be filled. Velaku kulam keachad b'churban u'bagola. And then they would all be punished with destruction and exile. Alvomikan ve'elech hotesia l'shut ba'aret. And he says what has happened is, until now, this hasn't been completed. Now I'm releasing the scroll. And now the punishment is going to be available. That's the way they take Nika. Radak disagrees. He says Nika means punishment. If you think of Parshas Kisisa in Shmod in Exodus chapter 32, when it says Vinake lo yinake, Nake can mean to punish. Right? I think Susan said that before. Nake can be a term of punishment. And that's the way Radak takes it. In source 10, he says Uperish Nika nichras. Nika means cut off. As in Vinake lo anakeka, there it's a positive, I will not cut you off, in the source in Yirmiyahu. And his point is I've been patient for them until now, but now they're going to be punished. However you read the word vinika, don't get bogged down in the grammar of the word. I brought it here because I think it's interesting that we could take it in different ways. But everybody agrees that the substance of the message is they have had their room to do what they want, and that time is now over, and now they're going to be punished. That's the message. Now, meaning either the Jews of this time and the sins they have, and a warning, you better get your act together if you want to build a temple, that's Radak, or Abarbanel. This is why the second Beis HaMikdash will ultimately be destroyed, will be for these sins. Giving them a warning 400 and something years in advance. They don't say you didn't know. But why these? Is it really that these are the only sins, and this is it, and there are two sins on their record, and it's stealing and swearing falsely? So take a look at source number 11. Which is not tied into our discussion in Zechariah, but rather into the issue of false oaths. It comes from a volume of the Talmud called Shavuot. Don't confuse Shavuot and Shavuot. Those are two different things. Shavuot are weeks. There's a holiday called Shavuot after 7 weeks. Shavuot are oaths. And that's what we're focusing on here. V'chol averos shebetorah. Im yesh lo zichus, tolin lo shnayim u'shlosha doros. All of the sins recorded in the Torah, for all of those sins, if a person has some merit, punishment may not happen right away. It may wait two or three generations. This is part of a classic idea within Torah that a family is seen as a single unit, and one member of the family might sin, and then others, even generations down the line, may end up paying the price. The Talmud is bothered by that and discusses that and says, well, what do you mean? We're also told ish bechad oyumas, that a person dies for his own sin. Well, that's the one that leads to the problem, right? How can you on the one hand say there's punishment down through the generations, and then on the other hand say that a person dies for his own sin? To which the Gemara's answer is, if you continue the sin of the ancestor, then God may say, okay, enough is enough. Which still means that there is punishment for the sin of the ancestor. At the end of the day, there still is, because otherwise you would say, well, his ancestor hadn't done it, then he wouldn't have been punished. But in any case, that's what the Gemara here is drawing on. It says that for other sins, punishment can wait. V'kan here, for these sins, nifron mimenu la'alter. If you swear falsely, you get punished right away. Shnemar, as the pasuk says, our pasuk, Hotseisia, Noam Hashem Tzvakos, Uba, El Beis Haganav, El Beis Hanishba, Bishmila Shaker, Velona Besoch Beisav, Vekilatu, Ves Eitzav, Ves Avanav, right? That pasuk that we just saw inside. Hotseisia la alter. God says, I bring out the scroll right away, which sort of goes against, so to speak, flies in the face of the idea that God has been patient with them for these sins. But he says, I take it out right away. It comes to the house of the thief. That is Hagonev Das Habrios. Thief does not mean someone who steals property, but someone who deceives others. She'elo Mamon Eitzel Chavero V'Tana U'Mashbio. Because what he does is, he goes to somebody and he says, you owe me money. And the other guy says, no, I don't. And then he ends up swearing. And you're forcing someone to make an oath needlessly in the hope that he's not going to want to take an oath and therefore he'll end up paying up. Into the house of someone who swears falsely in my name, that's kimashma'o, that's exactly what it sounds like, false oaths. Vilane besoch beisav, it will stay in his house, vekilato, and destroy his house. V'es eitzav, v'es avonav, as well as the wood and the stones, and the Talmud finishes here. Halamadata devarim shein eishu mayim machalan osan, shvuas sheker machala osan. Even the stones, which a fire could not destroy, and water could not destroy, right? Except if you're Rabbi Akiva looking at the stone with the water hitting it. But other than that, water and fire can't destroy the stones. This sin of swearing falsely, that will destroy the stones. I wonder if when he says here, the person who deceives others and lodges the claim, I think it's that he forces the other to swear, but I wonder if it isn't that he will swear. But Mashbio sounds like he's forcing someone else to swear. In any case, don't get bogged down on that. The point is, why these? Why are we mentioning these? These are considered to be the worst sin. What is so bad about this sin? Take a look at source number 12, please. Abarbanel says, V'hinei zachar bilvad chet ha-gineva v'ashvua l'shaker. It mentions specifically these sins, even though we know that at the destruction of the Second Temple there are others. Because this shows you that the national community in the Second Temple was entirely nifsad, worthless. Ein emes vein chesed vein das elokim ba'aretz is a pasuk from Hosea. There is no truth, there is no chesed, there is no knowledge of God in the land. This indicates when you have a system in which people deceive others and in which people swear falsely in God's name, at that point it indicates everything has fallen apart. There is no value that people are not willing to trample in search of their own enrichment. That's the idea according to the Gemara and according to Abarbanel. Ibn Ezra does not feel beholden to this idea. Ibn Ezra says the reason why this has to be spelled out is because it's hidden. No one really knows who's doing these things. Other sins are more blatant. You know about those things. These are things that are in private and therefore they need to be spelled out. It's another idea. But the point for us and what we should take away from this first of three visions within chapter 5 is that not everything is ice cream and cotton candy for the Jews at this building of the Second Temple. Yes, we've had some nice upbeat messages about what's going to happen, encouragement to build, going back to the book of Haggai, and in Zechariah talking about what God is going to do for them. But they have to know that there is accountability. And if they're going to steal, if they're going to deceive, if they're going to swear falsely, then it's all going to come crashing down. Whether that's, as Radak says, a warning for right now, or whether it's, as Abarbanel says, an explanation of what's happening down the line, they have to know that it isn't as though you're now God's chosen people and you have a blank check. It doesn't work that way for them, and that's a theme that will now carry through the rest of the chapter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.